Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, but I'm party.
And Jake Latondras.
And bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios on this Thursday night. You know what it means being Friday, if you're listening to this. Spence, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you, Rocky? Long time no talk, pal.
Well, I guess we can kind of go back over the past couple of days.
Yeah, I had a good time, man. Very good time. Thank you for the invitation.
I'll tell you what surprised me the most. Let me list out a few things for you. One, okay. That first day, it was absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, it was a beautiful day.
Tuesday morning, it was probably 40 or 45 degrees. It was
perfect.
Started
off chilly.
Morning to be in the turkey woods. Been cold, probably shut them down a little bit, but I would have expected turkeys to gobble like crazy on Tuesday morning. And I think that y'all were the only ones to hear a turkey that first morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and we heard a few. I mean, it was okay. Whenever you hunt around big fields, you know, big ag fields like that, sometimes it's hard to hear them, you know, because that sound just, you know, doesn't travel across those big fields as well, and you're just a long way from the next, you know, tree line. So, but it was very beautiful. You're right about that. About as pretty of a turkey morning as you'd ever want.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought they would have been burning it up Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. And Wednesday morning was a different day. We heard, I know that, well, Criswell was really the only one that really never heard any birds gobbling on Wednesday morning. I split off from Criswell and went to the bad spot, and I thought that I was putting him in the honey hole. I said, listen, I'm just going to get away from y'all with this camera. I don't want to mess anything up. This turkey's going to fly right down in front of you. I'm going to go down to the other end of this place and just listen and sit. And turns out the turkey that it was supposed to be right above him, of course, was down on my end. And it was a whole flock of turkeys.
Yeah.
And y'all got on some turkeys Wednesday morning.
Yeah, we did. We did. We listened from the same spot Wednesday morning that we listened from Tuesday morning. And we probably heard, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 birds, something like that, different birds all kind of spread out. So, you know, Tuesday morning, I felt like we probably heard 5 or 6 different birds, but they were real grouped up, kind of roosted in the same area. And Wednesday morning, it seemed like kind of as the day got warm on Tuesday, they split up a little bit more, but we see they were definitely spread out. And we got on one that was, man, he was setting the world on fire. He was up on top of a little ridge and some mature pines, and the acoustics were incredible. I think he was enjoying listening to himself gobble as much as we were.
I hope that you don't mind me telling this on the podcast, but you and Brooks, y'all ended up on a turkey, and you actually thought you hit the turkey. You actually thought you killed the turkey, but anyway, what's so funny is, I wish Brooks was here to tell this story, because this turkey is, 20 yards of Brooks, and he had the, I'll let you walk how it went.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, whenever you listen, obviously you're trying to pick out which bird's the hottest. He was definitely the hottest. He was gobbling the most, and so we started easing over to him. Halfway to him, Brooks got his little golf cart stuck, and we forgot to tell you that. We thought that's really going to screw us up, because kind of the little field that he was roosted close to was where we got the cart stuck, and, I mean, if he'd have flown down and come right to the field, he's seen the cart stuck right on the edge. But we eased in there to him, and, typical early spring hunt. He gobbled the brains out on the limb and, you know, gobbled his hens to him, and then he kind of went quiet. About the time that we were getting in close, you know, in fly down time, he just shut up. But he was kind of in a spot where, like, there was a house, this little block backed up to a house on one side and to a highway on one side, and then a field on one side. And so three sides were kind of – he was kind of boxed in. Like, there was nowhere to go. And so we started looking at it on the map, and we're like, man, he's either going to stay right there in those big mature pines and just hang out, or – he's going to ease out this direction. And we kind of had the only route out, because there was a pretty good sized pond in there too. And, so we kind of went where he had a nice, the easiest path, the path of least resistance out of where he was, and, set up maybe 15, 20 minutes of him being quiet. And finally he gobbled, and he was pretty much where he had been roosted, or real close by. So we eased up a little closer, quiet, a little bit, nothing. And then finally he gobbled, like maybe at a crow or something. And so we eased up a little bit closer, and we figured we were about 200 yards at this point. But we knew he had hens because he was quiet. And Brooks called a couple times, and the first mistake that we made was we split up. Brooks was kind of about maybe 30 yards from me and Dylan, which is a great way to kill a turkey. It's a terrible way to film a turkey, because, I mean, if you're going to film a turkey, you need the camera to be pretty close to the gun. You need to be able to whisper and communicate. That way, if the camera doesn't have him, the camera can say, you know, wait, you know, okay, got him, kind of thing. But for killing a turkey, Brooks did exactly right. We're kind of in this, on the side of this ridge, and he was like, man, he might skirt the bottom edge of this ridge, so I'm going to sit over here. Y'all sit up there in those pines. I said, okay. So Dylan and I sat up there up top, and Brooks yelped a few times, and nothing. And so I yelped a little bit louder on a box call. We're just kind of tossing different stuff at him. And the first time that I called the box call, he hammered, and he was only about 80 yards. And he was right down the edge of the woods, and he had clearly come a good bit closer from the last time we'd heard him. But it'd been a while, so we really didn't think he was coming. You know, we thought he had hens. And as soon as he gobbled, two hens flew from where he was and landed in the trees between me and Brooks. And so I texted Brooks to make sure. I was like, you know, you saw them hens, right? And he said, yeah, texted me back. And no sooner had I texted Brooks that did he see the turkey. I didn't see it yet, because he's kind of between me and the turkey a little ish off to my left a little bit. So I gave it a minute, and then I yelped again. And I yelped a second time. So I did kind of two series of yelps, and he didn't gobble. And at that point, I put my box call down, because I knew he had to be coming. I mean, his hens weren't with him. Why they flipped the tree, I have no idea. But he had to be coming. And no sooner did I put the box call down than I could hear him drumming. And sure enough, there he was. I mean, he was about 35 yards in front of me, maybe 40 yards. And he was about 25, 30 yards in front of Brooks, but Brooks had a wide open shot at him. And I think the hens had just surprised Brooks so much that he didn't have his gun up. And so, I mean, here's this turkey, and we've got him triangulated, you know, and he's 35 yards basically from both of us, wide open woods. And we're sitting there like a bunch of rookies with our gun in our lap. Mine was kind of up, but Brooks had his kind of the other direction. And, we piddled with him, and he strutted and stood there and strutted and stood there. And finally, he kind of eased behind some trees and looked like he was getting nervous, didn't see his hens. started like he was going to walk off. And I told Dylan, I said, I'm thinking I'm going to have to shoot this turkey. And so I texted Brooks and I said, do you see him? You know, if you don't see him, I'm about to kill him. And he didn't respond. And so the turkey kind of took two steps back and then he walked forward again. And when he started walking forward, I told Dylan, I said, this is going to be a Hail Mary, but I got to take this shot. And I took a bad shot, shouldn't have taken it. And he was about 40 yards walking left to right through some thick stuff. And I don't think I hit him at all. He flew out of there real good and strong. But they chalk one up for a miss, I guess.
I'll say this. And I'm not saying this because you're on the air with me, but if you don't have one of these Rolling Thunder box calls, I'm going to tell you something. They are one of the sweetest box calls that I've ever heard. I'm serious. I'm not saying that because you're here. Man, Josh had one, and I'd back off him. Whenever I'm with somebody, and we're on a turkey, like that first morning, we were 100 yards away from a gobbler. He never gobbled that first morning. We saw him. We got on him. And I told Griswold, I said, look, I'm going to back off, and I'm going to call from behind you. Because usually they've got that kind of line that they'll come to, and they'll gobble, and they'll strut, and they'll – because it's – science says the hens come to him. But man, all right, so Criswell's hitting this box call, and I'm 50 yards or 100 yards back behind him. Oh, my God. The way it sounded in those woods, holy crap, man, it sounded good.
Yeah. I'm proud of our box calls. We make a good box call. They're kind of the vanilla ice cream of turkey hunting. They're not as sexy to a lot of people, but I love a good box call. Crystal,
I'll say this. Crystal and I both woke up with a headache on Wednesday morning. A lot of people are going to say, y'all drink too much. No, not by any means. Let me just tell you, Tuesday night we cooked steaks that Spence brought, unbelievable steaks, but when you put Spence and Brooks together in Criswell to throw in his sly remarks every once in a while, you will die laughing. Man, I didn't know that Brooks was a storyteller that he is. He is awesome.
Oh, my God.
At telling stories.
Yeah, Brooks can tell some stories now. He's a lot of fun to be with, for sure.
I mean, my head was hurting from laughing so hard that night. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good time. Very good time.
All right, well, look, last week when we left the story, we said, look, I've told you this before. When I kind of started following you, not farted, but when I started following you, you know, I said that you use social media different than most people. Back in the beginning, back in, I guess it was 13, 14, Facebook didn't really have a video presence until the early teen years, 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. It took forever to upload a video, and it took forever for a user to download and play it anyway.
Yeah.
But around that time.
And they were short, you know.
Yeah. That's right. And, you know, I told you this before. You utilized, as a call company and as the owner of that company, you utilized social media different than most people, because most people were just going to post a video of them, you know, shooting a duck. You took it to a kind of a different level. I don't even know if you knew that you did it, but you kind of personalized it.
I don't know that was really intentional. I guess it was just kind of, I don't know, you know, I guess it's just a byproduct of kind of being real.
You did it different.
Trying to be who you are.
I mean, you just did it different, though.
Yeah. I can't say that there was much forethought in that. But I did feel like, you know, early on, I didn't really know how to do it, you know, but we carried a camera around a lot and figured, you know, you had to get, it just seemed like what all the other call companies were doing. And so we carry a camera and a tree arm, and we'd let it run while we were hunting and try to get stuff, and it didn't work very well. It's pretty hard to film yourself. I guess that really, the effort of doing that and then not getting anything that was worth a dang kind of really brought us to where it really was what birthed where we are today, because I realized about 2014, 2015, somewhere in that time frame, that you really just had to have, you had to have talented, qualified people to video and edit. You couldn't just, it just was almost impossible to try to do it all yourself. And that's what I was trying to do. That's where I ended up meeting Dawson. He was kind of our first cameraman, and we had a few other guys that worked, you know, on an occasional basis here and there, but Dawson was the first person that came and was just like, yeah, that's fine, I'll go, and just started following us around.
How did you meet Dawson? I mean, how did all that come about?
So the year before, Dawson came to work for me in 2016. And the year before Dawson came to work for me, I was pitching a television show to a handful of potential sponsors. And I was working with the people that Mark Womack, who owns a company called Sub7. Mark is the producer of a lot of the top-notch outdoor television shows. He's been producing Lee and Tiffany's show for a long time. He produced Craig Morgan's All Access Outdoors for a while, until they took it off the air. He produced the Foxworthy. Jeff Foxworthy had a web series for a while that was kind of like a full length television show. They hosted it on his website. It was called Foxworthy Outdoors. And man, he's done a bunch of other stuff. He did Penn Fishing Reels, had one called, I think, Open Water, and Swarovski has a show. He did their show. He did a big Benelli project for a few years there called Benelli on Assignment, where they traveled the country and hunted various things. And, I mean, he did Greg Ritz's television show. He's done a bunch of stuff for Under Armour. So these guys, like, I mean, they were kind of cream of the crop, top of the heap in outdoor television. And I met them because Mark's brother married a girl from Memphis, and we kind of became fast friends in the early 2000s, about the time I got married and he got married. We just became friends and started hunting together. And Mark and all his guys were from Georgia. And so a lot of his television shows would want to come duck hunting after deer season ends. Deer season ends in usually early January across the country. And so every year there for 11, 12, 13, 14, through those years, Mark would bring a television show out to duck hunt, just fun hunt together. And the one that he brought the most was Lee and Tiff. And they were so much fun. I mean, in terms of people in this industry, they're the most real, the most genuine, the hardest working, probably. Started from nothing and just gritted their teeth and, you know, made their dreams a reality. They're awesome. I mean, great folks. And they came and hunted with us. We had an absolute blast. And it kind of became an annual thing where they would, as soon as deer season was over, like January 10th, they'd come down and hunt for a couple of days and then go to SHOT Show, and they'd come back and hunt for a couple of days. And Tiffany really liked it and enjoyed the kind of the different pace than deer hunting. And the number one thing that they noticed from filming duck hunts with us was the ratings on them were so much better even than their best deer show. Anything that showed them using their dogs, people just really gravitated toward and loved it. And so they'd come down and hunt. And one year they came down and they'd snow goose hunt, stayed for a week and, you know, chase white geese with us and just, you know, just kind of became friends. And so I got to know Mark and a bunch of his camera guys through that.
So was it Benelli his idea? Hey,
sort of a joint thing. It was a joint thing. Benelli and Under Armour in about 2014, 2015 was dabbling with the idea of coming out with the waterfowl line. and they were a Realtree, a Mossy Oak licensee, and I think that they made some Realtree stuff as well, but they did, because Lee and Tiff wore Under Armour and Realtree. So Under Armour was the licensee for both Mossy Oak and Realtree, which is your two, major camo patterns, and Under Armour decided they were going to get into the waterfowl world, and Lee and Tiff were their biggest, that was their biggest sponsor. And so you had Under Armour and Benelli were kind of pushing Lee and Tiff for a mini series on waterfowl. So the conversation started. They were like, Lee called me and was just like, man, I don't know enough about duck hunting to do a series. He said, what if you did the series and we just came and hunted with you? And then, we can kind of help you host it, but it really would just be about us, chasing waterfowl with you. And I said, man, that'd be awesome. Are you kidding me? I mean, who would say no to that? And so we talked about it and kind of bounced it around. And that was sort of a short-lived idea for a couple reasons. One is Under Armour pretty quick decided that they weren't going to spend a bunch of money in the waterfowl clothing world. But it kind of started the process of talking about, in the process of talking about that, one of the things that became very apparent was there just really weren't very many high quality television shows about waterfowl hunting. It was RNTV, Zinc was doing a show, AVNX, but beyond that, there was a lot of, not to talk bad about him, but there's a lot of mediocre stuff being done about waterfowl. There was a lot of really high quality, top notch, big game stuff, but a lot of the big boys weren't getting into the waterfowl filming because it's just hard, it's difficult, there's a moving target, there's just a lot of things, there's water, there's boats, there's a lot of migration, there's a lot of things that make filming waterfowl tricky.
Don't you dare leave off the Flyway Highway. It's one of the top ones.
I got no comment. No comment.
Go ahead.
You got me there. But in the course of talking about figuring out a mini series, they batted around all kinds of ideas, like maybe, if Lee and Tiff produce, 20 new episodes a year, maybe it's just kind of we carve out part of the crush and it's crush waterfowl and be four or five episodes, or maybe it's just a whole, maybe it's a separate show on a different channel, or just we kind of brainstormed about all these ideas and then it didn't really pan out because, the initial driving interest didn't stay with it, but the conversations were kind of still going. And so, I just kind of picked it up and was like, well, man, let's do a waterfowl show. I mean, Sub 7 needs a waterfowl show. Y'all are top of the heap in turkeys and deer and, big game traveling all over the world. Like, why do you not have the premier waterfowl show? Let's be the premier waterfowl show. And we batted it around, talked about it, and Mark sent a guy with us for a fall, for a few weeks in Canada, or a few days in two trips in Canada, really, I guess, and a couple weeks in Arkansas, and kind of filmed some stuff. And we were kind of batting around the whole idea of maybe we could do a pilot episode. And so the rough game plan was let's film for a duck season and see if we could get enough good stuff to kind of build into a show. And there's different ways to produce a television show, but kind of one of the things we were looking at was how do we make it different than Duck Dynasty? How do we make it different, a little different than RNTV? How do we make it about us and the way we live? And at that time we all had a big camp, or not big, but it was a small house, but it was a bunch of people in Reno, Arkansas. And so it's kind of part of the storyline was going to be, life in Reno. And we started a text message chain called Reno Life. And Reno is this little bitty nothing town. I mean, I don't know what the population is, probably 150. There's a little grocery store there. And during duck season, we were living there. And all the waitresses in the restaurant knew us by name and knew what we liked to order. And we'd show up from hunting. It was literally about 75 yards out the back door of our house. So we'd all pull in. We had this big yard. Everybody's boat stayed hooked up to their truck. And we'd just pull in, kick your boots off, went on barefooted over to the restaurant. Half the time, you know, we'd have a beer and a styrofoam cup, and they made us lunch. And then we'd all go back to the house and sleep, wake up and go over, and they'd make us dinner. And they had a pizza oven, and so if we didn't make it in time for dinner, they'd have pizzas ready for us, and they just took care of us, and we loved them, they loved us. And so it's kind of going to be part of the show of this sort of nomadic lifestyle that we live. So in the process of all this, Mark, one of the biggest problems in filming something like this is you got to have camera guys, and you got to fund it up front before you kind of have the sponsors, and you got to get the stuff and show it to them and say, okay, this is what we can do. Like, you know, y'all want to put some money behind this, help us support this.
This is a multi-camera project.
It is definitely a multi-camera project, but even more than just a multi-camera project, the biggest thing is you got to have a guy that's willing to basically shack up and live with you. And that's not usually a middle-aged dude with a $50,000 camera rig and a wife and three kids. That's usually a college guy who, you know, looks about like Dawson, eats gas station taquitos and, you know, sausage rolls and, you know, is not afraid to sleep on the couch. And I mean, just, you know, I mean, it's just that's the kind of part of the course. So I started asking around, who do you know that does, you know, videos? And I mean, I started coming up with a list, and I mean, I've still got a list on my phone of people that are freelance, you know, day rate kind of people. And there was a guy that at the time worked for Drake. Drake was not sponsoring anything we were doing. We were just friends, but there was a marketing guy at Drake, and he gave me the name of a young guy named Carter Oliver. And Carter's still in college, and I think he was actually in high school then. But Carter came and filmed a resident goose hunt with us and rented equipment, I think. And Carter told me, like, the night before, he was like, hey, do you mind if my friend Dawson comes with me? I was like, sure. And he said, Dawson's done a bunch more of this stuff than I have. And I was like, that's fine. I don't care. I'm not paying either one of you, kind of thing. You know, or I don't remember what it was. Maybe I was going to give him a $100 bill, like a split. But they came, and Dawson borrowed a lens from somebody. He had a camera body, but no lens. And so after we hunted, we had a pretty good hunt, and they got some stuff. And after we hunted, we just all got to talking, and I said, well, you know, like, what do y'all do? Are you in school? Are you this? And yeah, yeah. And, you know, Dawson was like, well, yeah, I kind of am, but I'm taking online classes. And he's like, wow, what's up? And I was like, well, you know, we got a big honker feed over here. We're going to shoot it tomorrow. You want to film again? He was like, well, sure. So he filmed the next day, and then we got done hunting, and I was like, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And he was like, well, I don't know. What do you want? And I was like, well, you know, come with us tomorrow. And that turned into, you know, 5 or 6, 7 days in a row in September. And then, you know, I said, well, what are you doing week after next? And he said, I don't know. I'm, you know, what do you need me to do? And I said, you want to go to Canada? And he was like, are you serious? And I said, yeah, go to Canada. He said, well, I don't have a passport. And I said, well, that's no problem. You got a truck, don't you? And he said, yeah. And I said, all right, well, get in your truck, call tomorrow, call this number. And you can call the passport office in Hot Springs. And if you make an appointment, you can go down there and get your passport same day. You drive down there, make an appointment, call the phone, drive down there in Hot Springs, Arkansas, show up with all your paperwork and credentials and everything. They ask you the questions. They take your picture. Then you basically go and eat lunch. And in a couple hours, they call you back and say, you can come get your passport. And so he did that. And I mean, he, you know, like, came back and he had his passport. And he said, I'm ready to go to Canada. I said, okay, great. And he had class on like a Thursday. So I said, all right, well, I'm going to buy you a plane ticket. I'm going to drive up there, but I'm going to fly you since you got class. And I don't want you to, you know, have to miss class for this. He flew up there. And I mean, we just beat the brakes off of him for 4 or 5 days. And talking about a kid who probably, you know, hadn't, I don't know what Dawson would say, but he, at that point in time, Dawson had not been very many places. He'd not done a whole lot of traveling. And he had not done just a ton of duck hunting. He'd done some, but he didn't grow up. His mom and dad, you know, neither one of them were from families that hunted. And His dad was a football player, so he was just, man, Dolphin was just ready to go and having a blast. And we came back from Canada, and I said, well, Dolphin, I think I'm going to go back in a couple weeks, the end of October. You want to go? And he was like, heck yeah. And so he went back, you know, a few weeks later. So he went from having never been to Canada, that he basically spent 2 weeks up there that fall. I believe that would have been fall of 16, I think. And then stayed with us in Reno, the whole, literally lived on the couch at Reno. That house had 10 beds. We had 10 members, and we had a camper outside, 12 members, actually. 10 beds, 12 members, 10 beds inside. And then Ricky Rydell and Chance had a camper outside. So Dawson slept on the couch. Some nights he slept on the floor, face down in the carpet. I mean, just – and, I mean, he hunted – he was there every day that season. I don't think he missed a single day. Multiple times I'd leave him up there, come in, get in for a day or two, come back. He'd be in the same spot, clothes laying there on the floor, pile, people just sitting around watching television. And so we got some cool stuff, but kind of that year, I'm getting on a tangent, that year we sort of tried to film the stuff that we would need for a television show. That was the whole idea, was let's keep Dawson with us, get as much stuff as we can, and then Womack was going to send us a field producer two or three times. And he did, and we filmed some stuff, and we were going to kind of try to edit it and chop it together. And about halfway through that duck season, or three-fourths of the way through, we were kind of talking to a few sponsors here and there, and, man, people just weren't fired up about television. And I decided, after talking to a few people, like, I needed to just go to SHOT Show. I'd never been to SHOT Show. I never needed to go to SHOT Show. I tried to go to SHOT Show because I wanted to be a vendor. I wanted to be able to set up a booth and sell calls. But the way SHOT Show works, the firearms industry gets first priority over anything else in the outdoor industry. And so if you are a guy like me and you make a call or something that's just purely hunting, and there's no gun or gun part or ammunition accessory or anything like nothing gun related in your industry, it's really hard to get a booth. You're on a waiting list. I've actually been on a waiting list now for 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
And probably won't ever get a booth. You know, it's just one of those things. People don't give them up. And, but so anyways, I just decided I needed to go to SHOT Show, and I would take our stuff, kind of our sizzle reel or whatever you want to call it, to SHOT Show. And I would see, we would decide about a television show based on kind of the reaction that we got from everybody. And so I went to SHOT Show, took my buddy Derek Goddard, and we had no idea what we were doing. Just flew out there, got a hotel room, and like a couple rookies, we stayed in the Stratosphere, which is the thing that looks like the Seattle, you know, that space station needle looking thing in Seattle. Well, there's a hotel in Vegas like that, and it's like 7 or 8 miles from the convention center, so nobody stayed down there. We'd have to Uber back and forth, but for 5 days, we went and stayed the whole week, and we walked and met with people and kind of gave our dog and pony show and pitched the idea of a top-notch waterfowl television show. And, man, we might as well have been trying to sell sand to the Arabs or ice to Eskimos. And people looked at us, looked at me, and they were like, oh, that's cute. You know, okay, cool. You know, that's cute. But nobody really, there was almost no traction. And so came back from that and was kind of bummed.
That had to drive you, though. It had to just light a fire inside of you.
Well, it didn't really at first. It was a little confusing. I didn't feel defeated, because I still felt like, I mean, I wasn't trying, the difference between what I was trying to do and what everybody else kind of television-wise was trying to do, is I really wasn't trying to market myself. Okay, I wasn't trying to make this like Spence's Outdoor Adventures, or right. Even though that's what all my buddies from day one have called this, Spencer's Adventures. That's what Derek calls it, because we come up with these harebrained adventure ideas. And so he would always say, man, we just need to call it Spencer's Adventures. Like, like, no, Derek, it's not about me. This is about, you know, the call company and kind of what we're trying to do. And so in my mind, really what I was trying to do is I was trying to get other companies that were kind of like-minded to us to help us support an all market together. So I wasn't trying to, be, you know, Spence Halford, Great White Hunter or something like that. I was really trying to just market my call company, kind of like I was watching Fred Zink do and like I was watching John Stevens do. And I wanted to grow my call company by showing a lifestyle of what we were all about. And my theory was that if I invested in marketing my product that way through visual media, through videos, that it would pay back, you know, big time and tenfold, you know, that it would make it a lot easier to sell to the big box stores and to pick up accounts. And, you know, if I walked in somewhere and they had seen our television show or something like that, then I just assumed that it would be a lot easier conversation than them going, oh, okay, you make duck calls. That's cool. And so I didn't really feel defeated. I just was a little confused. It was kind of like, what, you know, why is what I'm saying not, you know, like when you're selling something to somebody and you're kind of telling them, this is why you need this. This is why it's a great thing. Here's all the positive things about it. And they're just kind of looking at you and you realize you're whatever you're thinking are the benefits of this thing that you're selling. And they're looking at you just with glazed over look. All right, I'm not meeting whatever burning need this person has. And that's kind of what I came back with was, okay, I'm missing the boat here somehow. There's something going on that I'm not picking up on. Why is it that, I mean, I'm bringing these guys something that they need. These are waterfowl companies and there's not a lot of options for them to invest in waterfowl television. Why am I not getting any traction? And so I started doing research, started asking other television shows. I called people like Jim Ronquist and asked them what they saw going on at RNTV and I went and met Fred Zink and at his shop in Ohio and asked him what he saw and met Jeff Shelby and Walt Gabbard and just kind of started probing and doing research. And I'd bring what I learned back to Mark and say, you know, this is what I'm learning. And really kind of where that shook out was television ratings were very suspicious at that point. Like people didn't really trust them. And then on top of that, they were not valuable to most of the advertisers. And so there was kind of this movement away from network television.
Hey, Spence, blow some people away. Yeah. Blow some people away real quick. Tell them what it costs to put a show on TV.
I mean, a low budget television network television production, you know, $250,000. I could rattle off half a dozen.
Out of that number, 200,000, what would you want to cover the whole thing by sponsorships or 80%?
So that's just a cat and mouse game. It's the television show business is just like any other business. It's an enterprise. It's an entity, and the business has expenses: travel, post production, cameramen, time in the field. You know, paying outfitters, lodging, bills, all the stuff that it takes to run the show. Okay, produce the show is the expenses, but the revenue it generates is advertising. Well, I say it's kind of a cat and mouse game because when you're first starting out, you don't have any ratings to show anybody. You're just telling them, this is what we're going to do. This is the network we're going to be on. Here's the time slot. And so you're kind of giving you're giving the marketing people these generic standards based that the network tells you. So like Outdoor Channel tells you, okay, if you're on this time on this night of the week, this is about what you can expect during quarter three and four. And this is what you can expect during quarter one and quarter two. And so but it's just totally a shot in the dark. It's kind of like going to the bank, telling the bank you need $500,000, you know, to build something. The bank's going to look at you like, okay, well, give us the blueprints. And and let's get an appraisal. And you're like, ah, yeah, well, you know, I'm building a an Eskimo hut and an igloo, and nobody in West Tennessee has an igloo, so you're not going to be able to do an appraisal. You're not going to be able to compare it to anybody because there's not any other igloos in West Tennessee. But, you know, we think that an igloo should, you know, it should appraise for $500,000. And they're going to look at you and go, no, we need some facts. You know, we need some proof that if we, you know, write you, you give you a loan for $500,000 or whatever the dollar amount is, that there's some value there that we're going to get back from it. And so you're kind of like the television show business. If it costs $200,000 to produce the show, what you want to do is sell $300,000 worth of advertising space. You have $100,000 left over. That's how the big boys make it. That's how the Lee and Tiffs and the Greg Ritz's and the Nate Hosey's and the, I mean, you can go Michael Waddell's and you can go down the list of the television personalities that their job is to make a television show. Well, they sell their show to sponsors for more than what it costs to produce it. And so the leftover, the net profit, that's what they live on. It's just a business. So when you start a new TV show, you kind of got to have some money in your pocket because you're gonna have to give away some sponsorships. You're gonna have to stick your neck out there in order to show people your product, number one, because you're talking about you're telling people you're going to produce 12 original episodes and you're going to put them on this channel at this time, but they haven't seen the episodes, so they don't know whether you're going to do good work or crummy work, and they haven't seen the ratings after your episodes, and they haven't seen the content that goes into your episodes, and they haven't seen how the public is going to, you know, relate to you. And so it's all just speculation. So you're telling them, well, we're utilizing Sub 7, and they're the top of the heap, and you know, they've done this show and this show and this show. So you're trying to show them that it's going to be a high quality production. You're trying to, you know, tell them these are the guys that are going to video it, and these are our friends. This is where we're going to go, and this is what we're going to do, and blah 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 blah. And you're doing this whole song and dance, and they're just kind of looking at you, going, yeah, that's cool. You know, let us know how that goes.
A big chance for them because your outdoor network TV is really, at that point, it's starting to go downhill.
Yeah, so at this particular time, what was happening was so a couple things were happening. One, so this is 2016-ish, fall of 16. I'd say summer, fall of 16. So one of the things that's happened is Sportsman's Channel is being bought or acquired somehow by Outdoor Channel. So now instead of three independent networks, you really only got two. Outdoor Channel and Sportsman's Channel are the same thing, and they're called Outdoor Sportsman's Group or something like that. And then you have the Pursuit Channel. Well, the Pursuit Channel is owned by a different group, and then you have some overlap in the Pursuit Channel in that there's a couple different entities that I don't really know what all the arrangements are, but there's some strong ties in with Mossy Oak and Moose Media and some companies that have similar, some joint ownership, you know, some of the same owners have ownership in multiple companies. So you got some movement in ownership of the networks, but you've also got some suspicion about whether or not the ratings are really real. And the way media got sold then, it still kind of gets sold this way, is basically on eyeballs, what they call cost per thousand, or I think it's CPM is the acronym. And so they'd take a gray-headed marketing executive would look at a program and say, okay, your ratings show that you generate 1 million eyeballs, and 1 million eyeballs for a waterfowl audience should be worth, and then they come up with a cost per thousand. And so if it's 35 cents per thousand and you multiply that out, you got 1 million eyeballs, multiply that out and, you know, $35,000 or whatever I'm just pulling out numbers, but they come up with what the value of the ad space should be. And this is how they do print advertising. It's just how advertising is sold. It's called a media buy. Well, for a media buy to be a thing and for it to be accepted and for the price to be accepted, two things have to happen. One, you have to have good numbers. You have to have good statistics and good viewership ratings. And two, you have to have companies that have enough money in their budget to spend on media buys, mass media buys, where they're not specifically targeting to one person or to one real tight-knit niche group of people, where they're just basically blanket advertising. Okay, so when the networks start to consolidate and the ratings are suspicious, people are suspicious of the ratings, well, immediately all the guys who have the big checkbooks are like, whoa, wait a minute. So you're telling me we're paying whatever it is, 35 cents per thousand, and you're not even sure what 1,000 eyeballs looks like, then they're real cautious. You know, they start going, okay, because somebody, they have to report to somebody about what they're spending their money on. So I walk into SHOT Show, and I'm a 35-ish-year-old, you know, goofy left eye, slightly overweight, you know, dumpy dude talking about, you know, filming duck hunts down here in the public woods in Arkansas. And we're going to do it top notch, and we're friends with Lee and Tiffany and blah, blah, blah. These guys are looking at me like, man, okay, that's cool. Have fun with that. And half of them are looking at me going, you know, we just had this thing called Duck Dynasty. It was kind of a big deal. These guys from down in Louisiana, they kind of made a big splash on television. And, you know, what makes you think we should do this again? You know, and So like I'm trying to sell this television show, and there's factors I can control and factors I can't control, but nobody's biting. And now I got 55-ish days of Dawson's time I gotta pay him for, and he's been sleeping on the couch, doesn't have a computer, so like he don't even know what I owe him, and I don't know if I got the money to pay him what I owe him. And so now I got a big bill for the camera guy, and nobody wants this television show. And I'm like, man, what the heck am I going to do with all this? And shortly after that, so this would have been now spring of 17, I guess. This would be 2 years ago this February, 2 years ago last month-ish. Lee and Tiff came to Snow Goose Hunt, and we were together for a week. And I was kind of bemoaning all of my frustrations of we've been filming, we don't have much to show for it, nobody wants a waterfowl television show, to Lee. And Lee said, man, you're going about this the wrong way. You need to figure out how to. First thing he said, Spence, let's be real for just.
That's where we're stopping this week.
Okay.
To find out what Lee said, you're going to have to listen to next week's episode. That is a great stopping point. And listen, it's a great part of the story, but even better than that, most of you know Dylan from Instagram. I don't call him that, but everybody at camp seemed to call him that, Dylan from Instagram. But how Spence and him brought Dylan on, that's a great story. First hunt Dylan ever went on.
Yeah. It's a good story. But
all right, so next week we're going to pick up with what Lee told you, because where we stand today, it seems that, you know, it kind of went into a web series, but not going to reveal that just yet. But
all right. Sounds good.
Because you know, I was just sitting here thinking as you're going through all this, talking about, man, the outdoor TV. Geez, man, what some of the money that was just blown in that, and it could have been dedicated to better resources at the time.
Oh man, it's still being spent. I mean, $200,000 is a cheap television show. I mean, most to have any sort of quality network television slot, airtime slots, I mean, you're looking at close to $100,000, probably $80,000 to $100,000 just for the airtime. That's not
That's not your travel. That's not your production cost. It's not your cameraman day rate. It's not your equipment. I mean, you can have $100,000 just in equipment pretty quick without, I mean, I don't have $100,000 in equipment, but it's not hard to spend $100,000 if you had it, you know, on camera equipment. It goes quick.
Hey, let me ask you a couple of questions real quick, because you studied this pretty hard back then. To be a title sponsor of a TV show, what does somebody write a check for on that?
Well, again, it depends on the network, and it depends on the ratings and your time slot. But I mean,
let's say the Outdoor Channel.
I cannot imagine that there is a show on network channel. Outdoor Channel is a lot more expensive than Sportsman and Pursuit. It's the most expensive. But I cannot imagine that there's a title sponsorship of a show that's cheaper than $50,000 a year.
All right, let's say this. I want to put a Duck South journal in a show somewhere. What's the product placement cost?
That's a little more tricky. Well, I think what you're asking for, like the next level down in outdoor television, it would be what's called a commercial sponsor, which is you get one 30-second commercial per airing of the episode. And the average price on that, I would say, is about $35,000.
I guess you're using that product and you get a 30-second commercial.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, this is what I've always wondered, and you're going to finally enlighten me. The guys that get the special thanks to when the show's going off,
mm-hmm.
what's that cost? Is that like a couple of $1,000 or something?
All of that is just negotiable, okay? It's all, I mean, there's no rules. I mean, it's all bartered and traded for, and what can you do to scratch my back? And, you know, there's lots of swapping out for, I mean, the big names, you know, they'll swap out personal appearances for some of the advertising spots. And, you know, they'll say, if you sponsor my show, I'll show up and do so many seminars, and you can use my face on your, you know, packaging of your calls, or, you know, there's just all kinds of stuff that gets traded out. Like when, for example, this is not a perfect one, but like when Lee and Tiff were sponsored by Realtree for years and years and years. All right. So part of their package with Realtree was they had to make a certain number of appearances. And at those appearances, you know, Realtree could sell hats or T-shirts or whatever they wanted. And Lee and Tiff would stand there and take pictures. And like, you know, 2014, 2015, Lee and Tiff would go to NWTF. There is no telling how many thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of hats and T-shirts and crushed DVDs that they sold, you know, just because they sponsored Lee and Tiff. And so all that stuff gets, the television shows are complicated because all that stuff gets negotiated into it. And so when you're one of the really big guys like the Lee and Tiffs, not only do these companies sponsor your television show, they have to also pay for your personal endorsement of a product. And so, you know, your television show then kind of becomes your platform to not only sell advertising space on your television show, but to also sell yourself. And so over time, that's kind of how you grow your presence and your television show. So it's kind of a complicated answer. You know, I mean, I would say that generally what happens is you have a title sponsor, you have a commercial sponsor, a commercial segment sponsor. Those are generally, let's just say, $50,000 for about a title, and or more, you know, 35-ish or more for a commercial sponsor. And then there's what's called like segment sponsors, which a segment sponsor could be.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's halfway right through the show, somebody's like, this segment's brought to you by, like Sea Light, for example, is a segment sponsor, I believe, of RNTV or Wonder Duck. You know, this segment brought to you by Sea Light. You know, and then they say their slogan and show a picture of a sea light. Or, you know, this segment brought to you by, you know, Yukonuba dog food or something like that. And so that maybe is a little less than a commercial sponsor because you're not using a 30-second commercial spot. You're getting a 10-second feature, and it's during the airtime.
So, you know, they'll sell those anywhere from, you know, $5,000, let's just say, to $35,000, depending on what they can get for them and the value to the sponsor and blah, blah, blah. And then you've got what a lot of people would call product sponsors. And product sponsors are basically just, they chip in a little bit of cash, but mostly they just give you stuff to use on the show. And those could be $2,000 to $5,000. And I did that a lot with the call company. I sponsored a couple little smaller low budget television shows and just to kind of see what it was like. And I mean, you can spend as much as you want or as little as you want. And generally the idea is the more you spend, the more pub you get, right? The more benefit you get and advertising.
I just kind of always felt sorry for those guys that just get the special thanks in that little second and a half that is up on the screen at the very end of after you run the.
Usually the special thanks, you know, to those guys is just that's somebody who gave them some
product.
Here's a few choke tubes, or here's a few duck calls, or here's a whatever, And, oh, okay, cool. We'll throw your logo up at the end of it. You know, it's kind of how that goes. Generally, those guys don't pay a lot for that. But
I have heard more and gotten more detail out of you tonight than a lot of people that I've asked have ever given.
Well, I mean, the television is very, outdoor television is very, very expensive. And the main reason it's expensive is because those three channels, Outdoor Sportsman's and Pursuit, it's like the only channel on television that the show pays for the airtime. Like A&E, the Discovery Channel, all the other channels on cable television, they pay the show to bring them content. So if you don't
sell your commercial time, they'll run their own commercials on your show, right?
Well, that's true. That's kind of a different arrangement. But what I'm saying is what makes outdoor television so expensive is that the actual show itself, like RNTV, they have to pay the network for the time. Well, right. On the cooking channel, you know, Paula Deen doesn't pay the cooking channel for her show to air. The cooking channel actually pays Paula Deen a fee for bringing them the television show. So it's kind of the other way around. It's backwards. On the every other channel, they go to these television show producers and say, okay, here's what we want. We want a story about this and this and this. Bring us a television show. Then those guys go out and they have a casting call and they write a script and they come up with a storyline and they bring the show back to the network and they say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring you a middle-aged blonde-headed woman and she's going to do this and she's got two kids and her husband and she's going to, you know, cook fish or something southern, or kind of they give the rundown of the show, and then the executives on the network sit there and go, okay, yeah, we'll do that, or you know, no, that's awful, go back to the drawing board. But when they strike a deal, the network is actually paying the television show. And in outdoor programming, it's opposite of that. In outdoor hunting industry, the show itself pays the network, and that's part of the reason that when you flip on the television and watch hunting shows, that's why there's so many low budget, crummy shows. I hate to say that, but it's because if you got the money to write a check, you can have a television show. Like, you know, if you want to write a check tomorrow, we can have a Duck South television show, and it can be as crummy and low budget as you want it to be. If we can afford to pay for it, we don't have to have any sponsors. It can be, you know, Spence and Rocky's Outdoor Adventures, and we can have somebody film it with their iPhone or with a handy cam, whatever we want them to film with, and it can be brutal. And you've seen some of those shows. They come on at 2 a.m. in between infomercials, you know, and it's just painful. And you watch it, you're just like, dang, like, I could do that.
I'm going to rush in the house and talk and discuss that with Roy and see what she has to say about it.
Hey, I can tell you what Lindy would say about it, because I've had that discussion with her before.
Before I let you go.
Roxy's adventure, but, Yeah.
Hey, before I let you go, I want to ask you this, though, because I think this is a great conclusion past where we stopped it. At the end of the day, your average video online is getting how many views, just on average?
I think we're running just north of 100,000 views, 508, something like that.
All right, if you were on the Outdoor Channel at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just getting you to guess. Just getting you to guess here. What was the eyeballs on that? What would you just guess?
I don't know about the Outdoor Channel, but on the Pursuit Channel, it would be pretty similar to that. That's better than some network television shows and not as good. It's somewhere in the middle of the pack, those kind of numbers. And to be perfectly candid, I don't remember the specifics. It's been two years since I did know that at one point. I knew what the average, you know, viewership was. But
at the end of the day, you're in on this, though, at about a tenth of the cost, right? Tenth or eighth of the cost?
I have to think about – no, it's more than that. I mean, it's I'd have to think about.
I'm not trying to get into your financial.
No, it's okay. Yeah. I mean, you're confusing with the fractions, but it's definitely a fraction of the cost. There's no doubt
that's the point I'm trying to get across. The biggest difference
is that my costs, I know what my costs are, and they're immediate. They're not long-term contractual obligations. And the television, you sign a year contract a year in advance. And so you got a contract, you owe that money, you got to pay that money, you got to provide that content. And so when you want to pull the plug on it, you basically, it's pretty hard to pull the plug on it. You're not nimble. It's not a just-in-time inventory kind of thing. And what I'm doing right now, you know, yeah, I got guys on payroll that are filming, and yeah, I've got expenses for travel and stuff, but it's a pretty short turnaround time. You know what I'm saying? In theory, if I run out of money, then I don't have to. If I ran out of money tomorrow, I don't have to produce a year's worth of stuff. You know, I don't have to pay for space to produce another year's worth of stuff. I'm more nimble, and that's the biggest difference between what we're doing now and network is.
I think you're more effective. I think you're more effective online than you would be on a network.
We can definitely. I agree. That's why we got where we are. That's why we're doing what we're doing. 100% agree. But you know, that's kind of different. Well, that's a slightly different direction, and that's where you want me to stop. So.
No, man. I just appreciate you. I appreciate you hanging around and walking through that real quick at the end.
Sure.
So, no Spence, it was good as always, man. Thank you again.
Good.
We want to thank of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckTales.com.